this episode, we have Sate joining us, founder and CEO of Hutch and Pimento. Now, Sate is an exceptional operator, having worked in the logistics space at both Feeder and Henchman before founding Hutch. Hutch is a customer-centric third-party logistic brand which helps e-commerce brands ship their products. After realizing that the third-party logistics software that they had built in-house for Hutch was a real game changer for them, they decided to start introducing their software and selling it to other third-party logistic companies.
Most of the incumbents at the moment focus on just what happens within the four walls of your warehouse. Pimento is very different, where we build for every stakeholder in that chain.
On this episode, you will hear from Sate and how his journey operating in the logistics space, along with the other startups he built, has really helped him get to this point where he is today with both Pimento and Hutch. This is an episode you do not want to miss. Welcome to The Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on The Startup Leap, we hear real, raw and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is the Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Welcome, Sate. Super excited to have you today. You are operating in such an interesting space. I mean, as a market, $31 billion in size, 15,000 3PL companies operating in the UK, and 5 billion parcels delivered every year. And that's only growing. So I'd love to get into your story. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, you know, you have obviously been working in the logistics space as an operator for some time now. I'd love to just hear about your journey from the early days. Tell us about your experience prior to starting Hutch and Pimento.
Yeah, so thanks for having me again, guys. It's an interesting one. I think there's so many places I could start from. I think the henchman story is probably a great place to start as it pertains to sort of the logistics part of the journey. So if I go a few steps back, I actually never finished college.
Oh, really?
Right? Yeah. Never finished college, never went to university.
Wasn't like the genius, you know, you already knew you were going to be, you know, business
person. I wish I could say it was, but it was... a lot of me figuring things out. Okay. I think when I was really young, my dad did a good, but maybe bad job at the same time, because he planted this thing called inquisitiveness and curiosity in me, which has its pros and cons. I would say largely the pros of sort of outweighed the cons, but it meant that I was interested in everything. And when you're interested in everything, it's hard to focus on something, right? So, didn't finish college, and I just remember having to sort of figure out what am I going to do. And I developed this really good skill of emailing CEOs to find work, right? So I never had a CV, and I would always just send an email to say, hey, this is who I am, this is what I can do, I'm willing to work for free, just cover my travel and I'll come in and I can help do whatever. And I remember coming across this website of the 50 most interesting startups in London type list. And I emailed every single one.
I love that. You're just shooting your shot.
Yeah, just shooting my shot.
It's sales. It's just actually pitching.
It was the first time I had to really pitch myself. And one of the first responses was from the CEO of Henchman at the time. And he was basically like, what are you doing tomorrow? I was like, I'm around, I can come in. So I made a trek to the offices in Tottenham Court Road. Had no idea that at that moment, it was such a shoot your shot moment that I didn't actually know what all of the startups did. I just reached out to every single one, right? My theory was it would be easier to do it with startups than it would be a regular sort of, I guess, a corporate company. Mm-hmm. So anyway, went to meet him, and then, yeah, he was just like, we spoke very briefly. He was like, I need help to do this. Can you do it? And I said, yes. He said, okay, cool. You can start tomorrow.
What did Henchman, like, what did they do?
Yeah. So Henchman was an on-demand delivery company. So essentially it was around the wave of your Deliveroos and your... actually pre-Uber Eats as well. And essentially the promise was we could deliver anything to you in London within an hour.
What year was this?
2014, I want to say, 2015. So the promise was we can deliver anything to you in an hour. They had categories on our app. So very similar to the Deliveroo experience that you see today. where you have the partner restaurants, but it also had this big button in the middle that said, get me anything, mm-hmm. right? So as a consumer, you could hit that button and actually the world was your, or London was your oyster, let's say, right? So customers were, we've delivered fridges, right? So customers would hit a button and say, I actually need a fridge in an hour. And we were like, oh, we have to get a van because we only have motorcycles on the road and we'll just make it work, right? There were things that people were asking us to move papers from
one place to another
and things like that. So it became sort of your personal courier, and the concept of henchman was like, it was your personal henchman. And at first we actually had all of the drivers in a black shirt, a tie, a bowler hat. So they'll swap their helmet for a bowler hat when they're delivering and hand it. So all of these little touches. So that was like my first foray into what logistics was, right? And logistics is one of those words that you hear, you don't really know the meaning of, right? Over the years, I've sort of come to my own definition of what I believe logistics to be. But during that time, I was pretty much the everyman of the company, right? So I did everything. I was doing payroll. I was managing the drivers. I was paying the drivers. I was managing our partner restaurants. I was managing the sales team. I was doing all of these different things, whatever.
How many employees were there at the time?
It got to, I think, about 35 employees. Okay. And in henchmen at its peak, I think it was in around 600 deliveries a day. And that experience was the best experience ever. And the reason why was the company died and then brought itself back and then died and then brought itself back about 7 times. And I think that journey as a learning curve is like, is you can't imitate that. You can't replicate that. It's really difficult. But in that, like, I learned so much and loads of those skills that sort of are applicable today. I remember it was so funny. I was catching up with a founder recently and we were laughing at this one time where the company had run out of money and he went on holiday. I don't know if he was burying his head in the sand. I don't know what happened. He went away for like a weekend and I'll never forget everyone asking me, are we going to get paid? Are we going to get paid? And I remember looking at the company bank account and be like, I don't know if we're, it's either one of two things. We've either got operating cash or we've got to pay everyone one of the two and it's not going to be both, right? And I remember coming up with a plan on sort of on the spot. And I remember calling the founder and be like, look, everyone's hounding me. It's a day before payday. Everyone's asking me, are we going to get paid? What do I say? And he said, say it, you figure it out, right? And I was a bit like, and I think I was like 22 at this time.
Whoa.
You were young.
Yeah, I was young. So then what I ended up deciding to do at the time was, basically, I remember calling everyone into the office one by one and saying, look, we can't pay you in full. What's the minimum we can sort of pay you for you to cover your bills? And I had this spreadsheet and everyone was like, I just need $1,000 to get me through. I need 800 quid. And I remember sort of paying everyone bit by bit and that allowed us to have enough money to do both. But it was like those experiences that really sort of shaped a lot of, I guess, some of the experiences today. But yeah, so henchmen ultimately died. That's where I met actually my co-founder now. And what actually had happened was the actual logistics part of the business got acquired by Rico Logistics, which is like one of the old school logistics companies in the UK. So they took all the sort of the physical assets, the motorcycles, the drivers and so on. And then the founders went off and took the tech and started something that's called Captain AI, which is just delivery management software. So I stayed initially with the logistics part of the business and Ben, who's my co-founder now, went with the software part of the business. Okay. So our paths, we sort of came together and we sort of
split
a little bit.
And you stayed in touch?
Yeah, stayed in touch. Ben and I stayed in touch. Our stories are very interesting because we both were doing startup-y stuff, right? And we always laugh because every time we'd done something non-logistics, it failed. And every time we'd done something logistics, it worked out.
It's like hint.
It's like hint. The universe is telling you something. Yeah. So our paths were sort of, even though they were separate, we were doing the same things away from each other. And then sort of when we came back sort of years later, it just, the timing was great.
And tell us a bit more about that coming back together. How did that come about? Because, I mean, you started Hutch right at the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
How did that come about? What was it that led to you two? What was that aha moment where you were like, let's do this?
And did you do anything before that? Like, was Hutch the first thing you tried? Did you experiment and fail with or without Ben? Lovely to touch on those as well.
Yeah. So I think it's very rare that an entrepreneur's they've got one pursuit, right?
Yeah.
So I've done a whole bunch of projects in between. Ben and I actually worked on a project. It's hard to call it a business, but essentially, we worked on a project called Recover, which was a Black mental health service, essentially. It was a platform to help Black people find Black therapists, mm-hmm. right? And it was sort of born out of one of my friend's personal stories, who was the first person I ever knew to go to therapy, right? And I just saw this person like transform in front of me, and it was like the most beautiful, amazing thing to see. And then when we started to dig deeper into that, he was like, look, I had issues. I went to loads of therapists. And actually, it was only until I worked with a Black therapist that I felt seen, I felt heard. And I was like, that should be everyone's story, right? From our community, especially with, if you look at the stats on mental health in the Black community, they're alarming, right?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting as well, because generally, like, 5 years ago, mental health was kind of a thing that no one really spoke about within the community, right?
Exactly.
It could be a thing where you get in a therapist. Why?
Exactly.
For what reason?
And a lot of people who have therapists now, we've made progress, but they still hide it from their parents.
Yeah.
They still don't share it. It's still a bit of a taboo to some degree. So, Ben was like just a hungry, yeah, I'll do it type guy. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll build it. I'll do it. So I was like, look, this is the idea. Here's all of the reports and the data. Ben, what can we do? And we sort of figured out, let's just build a matching platform. So we built it. Initially, we were overwhelmed with like the coverage we got and the signups we got. And essentially, I was up and down sort of London meeting with a bunch of mental health charities who wanted to, I guess, buy the product to then use in their communities, right?
How did they find out about it?
I reached out, yeah. I remember.
Great emailing skills.
I was emailing, yeah. I think I learned about CCJs. Do you guys know what CCJs are? So I learned about CCJs, which are clinical commissioning groups. So essentially the government have broken down, rather than deploying from the top how they spend money on services, they actually put that responsibility into the hands of local governments because they know their cohort more, right? So the idea was to go to these CCGs and sell the service, but target the areas that have larger Black populations because this is a product that could help their community. So we were on that path, but I think founder market fit is a very real thing, right? It wasn't my problem. It wasn't my story, right? It was my friend's story. And though I was very inspired by it and very moved by it, it wasn't my day-to-day experience. I hadn't even seen a therapist myself, mm-hmm. right? And I think those, I guess, gaps start to show as you're moving through the journey. And it's like the gulf and the knowledge gap to close, you realize is massive, right? It's so
Despite the passion.
So I think I started to find that it was harder than it should have been. You have to overcome the language barrier, right? It's a whole different sector. You have to overcome the lack of network barrier. You have to overcome your lack of profile and your lack of credibility barrier. And there's so much to overcome. So we ended up basically giving the assets away for free to one of the charities. And I don't believe they've done much with it, but we gave them all of the tools to be able to if they wanted to at the time. And then moved on to what I worked on after that, which was WonderPay.
That's when we first met, actually.
That is where we first met. Yeah. So at that point, I was COO in. And this is another story of poor founder market fit.
Yeah.
Right. And essentially, WonderPay was a travel/payments platform.
How did it come about? What was the aha moment for WonderPay?
So my co-founder, who loves to travel, his name is Raphael. He loves to travel, and essentially, he wanted a better way to pay for travel. And he saw sort of the trends of your Klarnas and so on. So he was essentially like, let me build one for travel.
Oh, interesting. So it was a buy now, pay later, like travel now, pay later.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly, travel now, pay later, the best way to put it. So we were building that, managed to raise some VC at the time, managed to get some customers on both the travel side, well, partners on both the travel side and the lender side. And we did quite well to build that. And again, that gulf was far bigger than sort of the one at Recover, right? We were learning two industries at the same time, travel and payments, right? We had experience in neither of them. And I think you guys are fully aware that, I guess, when you're on that sort of, I guess, VC sort of journey, it's about you need to keep raising to figure it out, to figure it out. And we just couldn't figure it out in time. And yeah, that story ended.
It's so interesting because you brought up a point of a right to the problem. It's something I heard a few years ago and it resonated so strongly that you can be very passionate about something, but you have to have a right to the problem. Why you compared to anyone else? Because even if you're passionate about it, one way I think of it is that I kind of think of statistically, what is the combination of team that will give this a good shot? Like they just have an edge for some reason, something about their background. So with you, what is your right to the problem? So even though you were passionate about it, you wanted to solve the problem. It was just that the gulf was just too wide. You were probably also competing with people where the gulf was just not as wide. Exactly. So you don't exist in a silo.
Exactly.
So that's super interesting.
Yeah, we it's always good to reflect once it's done. Right?
Yeah.
And I think when the business was done, we done some form of at WonderPay post-mortem, right?
Yeah.
Where did this go wrong? And I think we realized the deficit we were starting from was so big. I was spending evenings learning what does APR really mean? Like really trying to study APR because some people just know it because that's just the way their life, their path.
Can I ask at what point, because, you know, ending a business is tough. Like no one wants to detach from that thing they were so sure that was going to work. At what point did you have a conversation to say, you know what, it's probably not working? What did you hesitate? Like where did you draw the line? Because I'm sure there are people probably in that headspace and don't want to do it, but it's like there. How did you decide this was clearly not working?
Yeah, I think it was a bit challenging because one of the challenging things with, like, I guess, co-founding teams and teams is you might not get there at the same point, right? So I realized quite early and I was like, yeah, I don't think this is going to work. And I think the difference between myself and my co-founder, and I think you won't mind me saying this because we spoke about this, is one of the challenges I think founders have is they tie their identity to the business, right? I am Facebook. I am, like, whatever the name of the business is, right? Insert business name here. And I think that's what makes it difficult, right? If you think about the life of a founder, when you attach your identity to the business, when you bump into someone in the street or you're an old friend, before they even ask, how's your wife? They ask, how's business? How's the business going? And it's so intrinsically tied to your identity. That's almost like, who am I post this? And I think that's why a lot of founders keep going and they keep going and it keeps, one of many reasons. If there's one thing I'm good at doing is killing something when it's ready to die, right? I've always backed myself to come up with the next or produce the next, or even in our day to day, like I push the team to come up with new ideas and new ways to do things. But I have to also tell them that it's fine to fail. If it doesn't work, kill it, move on. And I think, obviously, it's not as easy when you've got investors and you've got customers and you've got all of these different things. But I think for me at the time, it was actually pretty easy to make that call because it just wasn't working, right? And I didn't want to sort of flog a dead horse.
So at that point in time, did you know that you wanted to go and build? And at what point, because I know that you then went on to work at Feeder. So when did you decide to go again? And what was that experience like at Feeder? Why did you decide to go to Feeder in between starting Hutch?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think at Feeder, so Feeder was a great experience because after WonderPay, I wrote this list of like the skills that I felt I was missing. So I was, again, COO-ing, but I felt like, a part of me felt like I was playing COO, if I'm being honest. We didn't have any major customers. We didn't have any, but I was so busy doing stuff. But none of it was the right thing. I wasn't doing stuff in the right direction. So I wrote this list of like, the next job I have to work with closely to a COO or a CEO that has these traits. And it just so happened that I found Feeder, and Feeder essentially, the founding team was a very commercial CEO and a very operationally heavy COO. And I'd done so much due diligence on those two individuals as people. And I was like, that's the place I want to work, only because I want to see it in action, right? I've started all of these businesses, I've tried, and they haven't really worked out, like why, but I need to see it working. I need to see someone who's executing in real time up close. And the business seemed to, they had customers, they had a thriving business, they were funded.
At what stage did you join?
So I joined Feeder when they were at, I think, sub 10 people. I believe. And I think they were probably around 18 months maybe into their business journey. And just for context, Feeda is a food delivery platform for businesses, right?
So again, in the logistics
space. So essentially...
was that intentional to go within the logistics
That was intentional. Okay. That was intentional.
And speaking of intentionality, I love the fact that you recognize where the gaps were. And in order to take yourself forward and for the future idea that you had to go and build again, you knew that you had some gaps to fill. So you went out to fill those gaps.
Absolutely. And I think when I did that post-mortem with Ref after Wonderpay, I was just like, yeah, that gap of that knowledge gap, I don't want to do it again.
Mm.
Right. So I was like, let me do logistics. I'm really good at it. Funny enough, one of my old friends from school has this like amazing, he remembers dates, right? And we work out together and stuff. And he was like, do you remember you used to always, because I love hats, right? He was like, oh, do you remember you always used to have the best hats in school? He's like, oh, like, do you remember how you got the money from that? I said, yeah, sort of. I don't fully remember. Essentially, he reminded me that actually my first hustle at school was a logistics business.
Okay, so this goes way back.
It goes way back. Okay. It goes way back. And actually,
speaking about that founder market fit,
I'm telling you. And it's like, I used to only the year 10s and year 11s were allowed to go out to eat for lunch. Mm. And essentially, I would basically go out and they'll give me £1 for everything they wanted. So let's say they wanted chicken and chips for lunch or they wanted Snickers for lunch. I had a trolley, like a Sainsbury's trolley.
Henchmen
from before. And then, like, I didn't actually link it together until my friend made the connection.
Sometimes it's only in retrospect that it actually makes sense.
Exactly. And I used to go with my trolley and I'll go to a whole trolley, push it. And I used to chain it with a bike lock in a park, unchain it, do the deliveries, then drop it back to school. And there'll be a big queue of the whole, literally a massive queue of the school. I got banned by the teachers.
Product market fit.
I got banned because they were like,
no,
our canteen sales are going down because of you. But
when you joined Hench, the other startup after Hench,
Feeda.
Yes. Did you know you were going to build a logistics company? Like, was it in your mind that, okay, if I'm going to try to build in this space, do I need to go somewhere that I know, you know, is best practice I can learn? Or was it more, I just need to upskill from what happened with Hench?
It was a bunch of so many different things. I think the next place I wanted to do a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
I felt at Wonderpay, I couldn't look back and say I executed on. Like, yeah. I didn't feel proud of what I did at Wonderpay. There was nothing really malleable, like, to hold and say I did this thing. So I always felt like I need somewhere where I know I can do good work.
Yeah.
And I knew I smashed it at Henchman doing like, the logistics stuff. Yeah. So I was like, I can actually go and do the same. But I always knew I wanted to get into logistics after. I wasn't fully sure where, how, and what.
It was just at the back of your mind. It wasn't.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
So went to Feeda. And as I was saying, they'll deliver to businesses. So their flagship product was called Cloud Canteen, which essentially was, if you worked at Google, you have this massive canteen where you have many options to eat. You don't have to leave the offices. And Feeda tried to replicate that at companies that don't have a canteen, right? That's why, hence the name Cloud Canteen. And every employee will have access to an app. And what we did in the background is we had a list of vendors and we had to logistically map them to the location of the office because we were delivering them exactly at lunchtime.
Interesting.
But you chose what you wanted on the same day.
Oh, that must have been a logistical
nightmare. So it was hard. Up until, so let's say you got your food delivery at 12.
Yeah.
For 400 people, you could order up until 11.
And then how did that work?
That just sounds like a nightmare.
So it was
nightmare.
Really, really hard, right?
And were you predicting?
Yeah.
Was there predictive analytics? So, like, just talk to us a little bit about the operations behind that.
So there wasn't much predictive stuff, but we did a lot of tricks like shrunk the menu, number one.
Okay, so you reduced the SKU, the
options,
you could order,
right?
Yeah.
We also did things like you could actually place an order the day before. So some orders will come in. But as humans, it's last minute. Oh,
exactly,
otherwise, I won't get my lunch. But it was just, we had to, a lot of the work was getting our restaurant partners operationally ready to deliver.
I was going
to
ask about that. What was the efficiencies like in that kind of business? Like, especially given the lack of predictability of the orders as well. Like, Was it highly efficient? Did you find that a lot of things broke, but it just worked? And the other thing I wanted to ask was, what was the revenue model? Was it subscriptions or was it, you know, people pay?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So in terms of the efficiencies, I would say it wasn't that efficient, right? And I think had we, the company eventually got sold, which we'll probably get into, had we probably stayed and tried to build out that product a bit more, I think the next phase was definitely becoming more efficient, right? We'll run into problems like our competitors, the restaurants would work with us and the competitors at the same lunchtime. So not only are they getting 300 orders from us, they're getting 300 orders from somebody else. So then we had to learn to put that into contract where, and actually come to the table maybe with the other competitors and say, let's make sure we don't overflow the restaurants on the same day and work together and things like that. So there was a lot of efficiency gains to be had, but we were improving all of the time. Right, we worked with some partner delivery drivers. We had our own delivery drivers. We worked with, I think our industry really pushed cargo bikes in London and got them a lot of work because cargo bikes are actually the ideal vehicle to use. They can weave in and out of traffic, but they can take a large load and they don't get stuck in traffic. But then you run into an issue maybe where you have to go into a loading bay where you need a van. So there was like so many things. To do there. So I think from an efficiency perspective, we were always trying to push, and that was basically my main KPI, right? As a sort of head of operations there. In terms of the business model, it was quite interesting because you'd be surprised at how many, the offering was sold as a perk to companies, right? This is how you can sort of enrich your employee experience. They get better choice of lunch, therefore they're happier, therefore you retain your staff and so on. You'll be surprised at how many of these companies subsidized the lunch for the employees. So an employee will log onto their account, see the menu, and they'll have credits. Each credit represents a pound. And sometimes you'd have already 5 credits per day preloaded by your employer, or you'd have 0, and you just top up the difference based on what you order. And then we took a commission, almost a delivery model. Okay. So we took a commission from the restaurant, and then dependent on sort of the setup or the service, the companies paid us as well to sort of, I guess, onboard that service into their company. So that was sort of the feeder journey. I think I was there for just over 2 years.
And then they were acquired, right?
Yes. So they were acquired by Compass Group. So Compass Group are the company that go to the big offices and install catering, well, I guess, office, lunch, yeah, canteens and things like that. Compass Group bought them. And yeah, that was the money, the seed money I used to start Hutch.
Oh, so it was the proceeds that you used to start Hutch.
Yeah.
Before we get onto Hutch, obviously you went into the company knowing that you wanted to develop some certain skills, right? What was the key takeaways from that experience that you took into Hutch?
Yeah, so a lot of it was... Henchman, going back to Henchman, was chaos, right? It was like startup chaos. It was loads of young people running around, figuring things out, loads of bad decisions. Feeder was grown-up Henchman, right? It was like a grown-up experience. And I think up until that point, I had never had a grown-up business startup experience. Everything was very like... in the dorm, hacky and just hustling and
vibes.
Super early.
Yeah.
And I'd never worked for a startup, which was still a startup, but like...
At least had some playbooks, some best practices.
Exactly, some playbooks, worked. Like consistent cadences, like rules and things like that. And that was definitely a massive mind shift because I think sometimes we fall into the trap that scrappy is amazing, but you don't have to be scrappy, right? And I think the target should be... get out of scrappiness, right? Let's start scrappy because you have no choice.
Yeah.
Let's work to get out of scrappiness and let's be structured. Let's be organized and let's be an actual company. So that's sort of the main thing, right? So at Hutch, implemented things like OKRs very early, right? Because I saw them work so effectively at Feeder. Some people think that handicaps you early on.
Yeah. It
actually did wonders for us, right? So there's so many different things that took and moved on.
So Compass Group comes, acquires the business. And is it that point that you decided to leave?
Yeah. So it was a weird time because it happened as lockdown was happening. So we actually thought the deal probably might not happen. Right. And it was when we were all sort of, some of us got furloughed and some of us were working from home. I used that as an opportunity to like sneak off and start building and so on. And what happened was initially what I was trying to build was same day and on-demand delivery for e-commerce, right? So the plan was to have these micro hubs, micro warehouses, and to use those to power same day and fast delivery.
Was some of that spurred by COVID?
It was spurred by COVID. It was spurred by Feeder. Because that Feeder as well, I learned about all of these tools that I can use to run the back
office. Yeah, back and gain efficiencies that actually create reliability in the delivery of the service.
Exactly. So that was sort of, I guess it was like a step because it showed me actually we can do this with this tool. I understood this software. I understood the market. I knew how much it would cost to build this sort of tech infrastructure without actually coding like a lot of these tools. We could link together to build a sort of on-demand delivery business. So that was the intention. And then I was speaking to loads of people that had brands, right? And just asking them like, what are you guys struggling with? And it was such an interesting time because all of their orders were increasing because of COVID, but they were literally physically handicapped because of COVID. They couldn't physically go and post. They couldn't do it. So I was like, I'll do it for you guys. And I told everyone soon, same day delivery's coming. I'll do your regular fulfillment. This is how it sort of started. And same day delivery's coming. There's an interesting story as to why we never did same day, which essentially is when I managed to rope Ben in.
Yeah.
He said, because he was so burnt from his startup journey, he was like, unless you can get it to work on a spreadsheet as a business, I'm not joining you. So I went back to try and I actually couldn't get the economics to actually work in a sustainable
interesting way. I love that. There is something about a back of the envelope calculation. Like, how is this a business? Tell me what the unit economics look like. Just on a, you know, we know it's not going to be like that in the future, but just make it work with some assumptions. Interesting.
Yeah. And I think we had both of our business, like at Henchman, it was like this imaginary, when we get here, we'll become profitable. Or when we get here, we just need to make these tweaks and the unit economics will work. But 99% of times that point actually never comes, right?
Can I just say, that's one of the things I really loved about. So I obviously we met in the very early days of you thinking about Hutch, and you were so focused on the unit economics. And it was at the time where the market was like growth at all costs. So you were an outlier from that perspective in terms of thinking about how are we actually going to make this work from a numbers perspective. So it's just interesting hearing, you know, Ben's view on actually, if we're going to do this, we need to make it work from a numbers perspective and thinking about it very early and how that's propelled you to get to where you are today.
And can I ask, the numbers you did then and now, like after time passed, did it check out or was it like an exercise that really helped you think at the time but didn't quite match up to reality? Or do you see threads across both?
Yeah, so it's such a good question because number one, I have to give Ben a lot of credit because he was really hammering home. He was like, mate, basically both of us were tired of hemorrhaging cash. We were tired. Like we were so tired of raising and spunking it and raising and spunking it. So what we did is we went to all of the competitors at the time and I just copied their business model and I just imprinted it onto a spreadsheet. So I got quotes from all of them. All of them priced differently, but I got to some middle ground. Basically plugged their model into a spreadsheet and that was, we just said, that, imagine this is our model. Can we make this work? What does this look like when we're at 5,000 parcels? What does this look like when we're at 20,000 and 60,000 and so on? And we said, there's a business here. And then we said, okay, how do we become more efficient and more profitable than the incumbents? And then we said, okay, if we make tweaks here, if we build this in this way, if we do that. And that was sort of the start and the genesis of our thinking.
So this was right before anything was built.
Yeah. So before we started, and when a lot of sort of young entrepreneurs come to me now, I always say, start with a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Start with a spreadsheet. Build a model. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be, but ask yourself, is there a business there?
And if people start with a spreadsheet, what are they looking out for? Because there are two sides of this camp. Some say like, look, things are going to change so rapidly. I don't really care about a spreadsheet because whatever is there is fiction. What's going to happen in real life is probably going to be different. Others say it's the exercise that counts. It's not really about what it comes. So what's your view? having started with the spreadsheet and gone through the experience, what would you say if someone was starting with a spreadsheet, how should they be thinking? What is that supposed to help them do?
I think there's two sort of things I think about. I think this is, I guess, the way I think is way more applicable to a service-based business, mm-hmm. right? Product, I think, is quite different because mm-hmm. you're trying to find product market fit. You're trying to figure things out. I believe with service-based businesses, your goal is to make money from day one, right? Mm-hmm. Try and make money from day one. And I have this sort of big theory about like product businesses for me are still the holy grail. Mm. But I think the best way to get there is via service-based business first, right? And I think there's so many reasons why I think this, but in terms of sort of the spreadsheet question, with a service-based business, it's like try and make money from day one. If I eventually, have an app where someone can request a window cleaner.
Great, yeah.
Right? That's great. But a better way is to start cleaning windows yourself, right? And you can make money from day one. You just knock on 100 houses and say, do you want me to clean your windows, right? And then work out, does that work as a business model? And then that gives you the time, the profitability, mm. the base, you're in control of your own destiny. Mm. You don't have to focus on fundraising. You can sort of just work your way to the product part, mm. right? Over time. And if you want it to take 2 years, it can take 2 years. If you want it to take 8 years, you can do that. And on that journey, you're picking up networks, you're picking up know-how, mm. you're picking up customers, you're picking up learnings, you're picking up all of these different things and doubling down in that space.
Got it. So it's more like a way to buy yourself time, really.
I believe, 100%.
I think this is really interesting because obviously we're seeing a lot of AI-enabled service businesses, right? And oftentimes these service businesses are very low margin, require a lot of humans, a lot of friction typically. And so where AI is applied to these businesses, we're seeing margins rapidly expand and so on. I want to go into particularly how you thought about the software piece and applying that to 3PL. Because if you look at the 3PL space, most players do use very old, legacy, clunky software, right? And how did you think to actually build something that would drive efficiency, but then take you to where you are now with Pimento?
Yeah, so it's a great question because when we built, so if we go a little bit back, when we sort of fleshed out Hutch a bit more and we started to get our first customers and started to deliver the service to them, we actually looked for a warehouse management system, which Pimento is, to run our warehouse, right? And our plan was, Ben is actually technical. And the plan was to, we didn't want to build one from scratch. And the plan was to find one off the shelf and then build on top of it, right? Our early customers were very demanding in terms of what they wanted their service to look like, what they wanted their experience to be for their customers, which was a good thing because it raised the bar. But the existing tools didn't allow us to do it, right? Yeah. The existing tools dictate to you how you run your warehouse and how you run your operation.
So what was the alternative for some of these brands that you were working with? Would they just build out their own in-house systems?
They use legacy tools.
They'll use legacy tools. Yeah. So in terms of like the customers using Hutch as a 3PL, they would just either fulfill themselves or... use somebody else who is using legacy tools, legacy software. And in terms of our software customers, they'll be using those legacy platforms that, again, are very rigid and sort of force you to ship orders out in a way that they want you to, right? So we went through that journey. And I think very early we said, yeah, these tools, they suck. They're really bad, right?
How far into Hutch did you start getting
that? Almost straight away.
Really?
So we did an initial phase of looking at tools to use, to implement. It's very difficult to build a 3PL business without software. You have to manage your inventory, track your orders. Track.
This is the second time it's happened. We had a guest who started like a CPG business and then went to actually build software to make it more sustainable because they found that there were issues with
Absolutely. And I think our view was we had two sort of things that we're trying to build for. One was building platform that allowed our customers to deliver the best experience to their customers, right? So to give an example, some customers want on a Tuesday, any order that goes out on a Tuesday, we're doing a promotion, we want to put in a biscuit. Or I want to put a handwritten note that says this. Mm. Or if we mess up and we send out a replacement, I want a specific handwritten note that says, sorry, we messed up. Or if they spend above £80, I want to put in an additional shampoo. Something.
So it's like this personalized experiences, but are common that you want to scale.
You want to scale.
To improve customer experience.
But the existing systems don't allow you to do it. So what kept on happening is you have these brands that have these broad ideas and these ambitious ways to deliver a great experience. Then they go to 3PL and they say, we can't do it. Or we can do it, but it's going to cost you £8. And that was because £8 or £9 and... But that was because they didn't know how to do it profitably. They didn't know how to scale it. Because
the existing systems also handicapped them.
Exactly. Okay. So that was sort of our first goal. Can we build a system that allows us to deliver that to our customers? And the second, back to sort of the numbers bit, can we build a system that helps us be profitable all the time, right? So we're just building it for ourselves and we're like, we always need to be profitable. We need that visibility. We need those efficiencies and so on. And we need to build all of these core sort of, I guess, sexy tooling to allow us to help our customers deliver great experiences. So as a 3PL, we were winning a lot of business from other 3PLs because we could deliver that capability. Mm. So when we were ready to, I guess, launch Pimento, we ended up with this offering that was a warehouse management system catered for 3PLs and brands who want to deliver great experiences to their customers and also run a profitable e-commerce operation.
And do you think you would have been able to start Pimento without having gone through that whole experience with Hutch?
No.
Did you validate Pimento? Because you said that the other 3PLs were already using you because of the software. Was that the signal that, okay, maybe we just sell this thing directly to them? What was the validation, you know, process within Hutch into Pimento?
Yeah, so essentially, we first and foremost, we made a lot of 3PL friends before we even thought about doing software, right? And we were always...
Do you send your cold emails again?
Cold emails, just reaching out. And we were very shocked when we were understanding, like, their gross margins and their net profit. We're like, you guys aren't... You guys aren't on the breadline.
Yeah.
And we were doing so well. And we realized, actually, our software has a massive part to play in that.
Because a lot of these 3PLs are like...
Yeah, the margins are hard.
Exactly. Like
20-year-olds.
Like, exactly. A lot of them are mom and pops. Exactly. A lot of them are smaller operators. So we realized, yeah, your margins are squeezed. And then we also were always winning customers from them. And the first bit of feedback we'll get is, yeah, we didn't like the system. Because the brands have to interact with the system as well. We didn't like the system, or they can't fulfill on these requests that we have. And we're like, yeah, our system is our special sauce, right? What happened was one of our brands, because our system works for brands and 3PLs, one of our brands was like, look, my dad has got space in his warehouse. We're just going to take stuff from Hutch and we're going to fulfill ourselves. And we're like, that hurts. Like, because you're not leaving because we've provided bad service. It's just another opportunity opened up. And then we were just like, should we just give them the software just to run it and just see? And we gave it to them, sort of forgot about it. And I'll never forget, we had a call with our accountants and they were like, yeah, so you da-da-da-da-da. And you got this 15 grand from this customer. We're like, huh?
What?
Wait. We completely forgot that they were paying us. And they were like, oh, so this is what SaaS is about.
You're like, must be nice.
So you don't have to work every day. You don't have to ship parcels every day to get the money. Yeah. And that was sort of like the moment where we're like, that was like the easiest money we ever made. So then I sent one of the cold emails to about 33 PLs just to see what was going on. And basically the email said, hey, I'm Sate, just like you, I run a 3PL, but unlike you, I built my own system. This has allowed us to scale to here, here, and here. And I think we are better than incumbent one, incumbent two, incumbent three. I'd love to do a demo book time here. And I just got loads of them on a call and all of them were just blown away. They didn't have any questions about the system and concerns about it. The main questions was, you're a 3PL as well. You're going to steal our customers.
I was going to ask you, tension between corporation and competition. Exactly. Did you face that? Like, how significant was it?
Very.
Okay.
Very. So 3PL owners typically are quite paranoid because you put in so much work to win a client. So we had to build that trust. One of the things we did was essentially convince them that actually the software opportunity is big for us, so we'll never steal your customer. We had to put it in contract. So in our contract, there's like a non-sort of solicitation piece there. There were instances where, coincidentally, my sales team at Hutch were going for the same client, and I had to tell my salesperson, just come out of bidding for that and just let them win it. So there was a few things we did there to get them comfortable. And that's one of the reasons why we decided to separate the brands and split out into Pimento, just to sort of give them that a bit more comfortability around that.
I'm just curious, obviously you had that first customer, right, where you decided to give them the software and you had this aha moment. But how did you decide on pricing for the successive customers that came after?
So what we did, and our pricing sort of think about it still the same. We looked at the incumbents and said, we're like 30% better, so we charge 30% more. essentially.
I love that.
So the way our plans work is we have like a basic plan,
yeah,
which is comparable to the incumbents. So if you just want to go feature for feature, you can use that and the pricing is comparable,
mm,
right? So if you just want a better system that has the same features, but we just do it better,
mm,
use our sort of base plan. And then we have two other plans that have additional features, which no doubt will cost more than the other, yeah, sort of the other base plans.
Did you toggle the pricing? Because I feel like pricing is a bit of an art and a science. Sometimes you overcharge and then you're like, yeah, we're pushing it. Or no, maybe we hold and then people come. Or you undercharge and you're like, yeah, no, this is way too good a deal for them.
Yeah.
We need to move it. Did you have to make those calls or did you get it right?
I don't think pricing, you ever get it right.
Yeah. It's a journey.
It's a, yeah, journey, and it's like, it's constant iteration. I think there is this like biting point that we like, even with the fulfillment business at the time, where basically you make the customer wince a little bit.
Yeah, and that's when you know it's,
yeah, that's when you know it's like, yeah, yeah, they wince a little bit.
If they're just like, oh, that's fine.
Then you're like,
yeah, 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 exactly.
I lowballed. Bit, yeah,
yeah, exactly. You lowballed. So you want them to have a little bit of, not a, that is way too expensive, I'm, yeah, never talking to you again, where you almost offend them.
Mm.
But just like they wince a little bit and then they make the purchase. I think what we're really good at in our sales process is always selling value. Right? It's the value. And I think one of the beauties is we have a showroom. Hutch is a showroom for Pimento, right?
Ooh, that's a perfect customer acquisition channel.
It's a perfect,
yeah,
channel, right? And what that means is we can actually really show you,
yeah,
the efficiency gains. We can really show you the cost savings. We can sometimes, so when you're in a warehouse, there are multiple ways to pick an order, right? And pack an order, depending on the profile of the order, mm-hmm, right? And where there's probably, the world has seen 30, 40 different picking methods. We focus on like 4 or 5 and we're constantly adding the better ones, right? And building out the better ones and thinking through how that works logistically. But what we do is we will launch a new picking method. We'll test it in Hutch and it will bring that case study into the sales process and say, look, before this picking method, this is what efficiency, mm-hmm, looked like. And now it looks like this. And then we invite them to come down,
yeah,
to the warehouse. So it's actually a physically showroom, which, mm, the other software providers
don't have.
They don't have, right?
I love that because we speak a lot about design partners, like finding customers to build with, but you have that,
yeah,
in Hutch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You're your design partner.
Exactly. And I'll ask you guys a question, right? Maybe trivia.
Yeah.
What percentage of customers that have visited our Hutch showroom have converted to customers, like Pimento customers?
Ooh,
60%?
Yeah, 50%.
100.
Wow, ooh,
that's incredible.
That is compelling.
It's,
I mean,
compelling.
If you see it, there's no reason not to do it because the reason you probably wouldn't do, like, I'm not even sure if it, yeah, works. I'm probably just talking.
Exactly.
Interesting. 100%.
100%. And I think also it's because the journey is quite long. You've made it before. I think they make the journey. So I made it. I have to. This warehouse is a,
it better be good.
So I think there's probably a part of that as well.
And just curious, because obviously that's a service business with Hutch and now Pimento is pure software. What sort of mental models did you have to take into account? You and Ben building out Pimento, and how did you think about the team? And how are you managing Hutch now? Who's managing it?
Yeah, so I guess
because that's still running fully operational, right?
Yeah, yeah, fully operational. So we knew that before we fully focused on Pimento, and it's why it took a bit of time. We needed to get the foundations of Hutch in terms of a management, from a management perspective, really, really sturdy. So we spent a while just really building out like our management team. So we operationally day to day, the last time I went to the warehouse was like 3 weeks ago. I typically go probably every 3 to 4 weeks. So it fully runs on its own. We catch up with the managers every other day. We have our stand ups. We have certain sort of cadences. So that's running really well. In terms of the mental models, it's a really good question. Right? Because our journey was like very startup-y. We went to every startup event, listened to every startup podcast. And then we realized very quickly that a lot of this stuff didn't apply when we were building Hutch, right? You mentioned like a growth at all costs mindset, which didn't apply to Hutch and loads of these different things. So we're sort of like entering back into that sort of mindset. And I think staffing is a really important one. So the way we've employed staff for Pimento are these fast, hyper growth sort of mindset individuals. Whereas on a Hutch side, still amazing, amazing individuals, but they're more about operations and customer experience and business as usual, if that makes sense. So the Hutch staff are very good at, okay, we do this every day, let's improve this percent at a time. Whereas Pimento is like, we have to grow it like and improve it 20% and 30% every time. So it's a little bit different.
I bet you also almost have to have different personalities when like thinking about both businesses and leading the team.
100%, 100%. Even the way we look at the P&Ls are different.
Yeah.
Where we think about our, like, for example, the way you would allocate revenue spend. So how much you make and how much you're going to allocate of that to how you're going to allocate the spending of that. With Hutch is completely different, right? With Hutch, we always try to have some form of, I guess, cash held because it's a heavy operational business. You never know where you're going to need a forklift. You're never going to know where you need extra racking. So you need to be a bit more conservative there. And then with Pimento, it's a software business. Your margins are way more healthy and way more generous. So the way you allocate that sort of revenue back out, it's completely different.
Can I ask an edgy question? Of the two businesses...
It's like comparing children now.
I'm just saying, not pick, but of the two, which would you say from an like ROI perspective? Like when you think about the effort you had to put in, I know one cannot exist without the other.
Yeah.
The two of them. But if you think about purely from like a business model, which one, you know, really excites the entrepreneur in you that likes to make money?
It's such a hard one because with Hutch, there was, especially when we came back from a very, we had logistics experience, but with Hutch, there was something really good about your business being physical. You can see staff, you can see boxes, you can see racking. Like it felt like very real. But to be honest, the Pimento, the reward, I check like our customers and the fact that, I'll give you an example. Our system's only gone down once.
Oh,
went down for 2 minutes. In that 2 minutes, we received calls from every single customer in that 2 minutes. And that showed us how they rely on the system, right?
Yeah.
And sort of being like the platform for other 3PLs and brands to, as I mentioned, deliver great experiences and be profitable. Like it's, I don't know, it's a really good feeling. Yeah. I think we onboarded a jewelry brand not too long ago and we did like a what we call like a handheld onboarding. Went over there, onboarded them. And I just remember calling the team. I went outside, called the team. And I was like, guys, like the difference we've made in 24 hours is insane, right? And they keep coming up to me whilst I'm in the warehouse. Like, thanks so much. Like we've been telling our bosses to implement this for ages. And now like I can just chat things from home and I'm so much efficient and I can delegate work within the warehouse and I can do all of these things that they couldn't do before. So I think there's definitely a good feeling about empowering others.
I wanted to talk a little bit about fundraising because you, I guess we could say that you're quite privileged in that with Feeder, you obviously had the acquisition, which you then used to fund Hutch. And obviously I'm a very privileged investor in Hutch. But I'm just curious, like how you thought about fundraising with Hutch and how you're thinking about that with Pimento.
Yeah. So I definitely recognize they're two different journeys, right? But I think I had to do a lot of learning on a Hutch journey to understand what I guess fundraising vehicles applied best to that type of business. I think I was a bit naive in that I saw fundraising as one thing, right? I didn't really separate angel and VC and PE. I knew they existed, but I didn't know how do you apply them to your business case? How do you apply them to your end goal, your story?
To make sure they fit. Every funding is for your business.
Exactly. And it was in a time where all of my entrepreneur friends were raising VC. So it was very difficult to not just jump on the treadmill. But I think some of the things that happened, so we raised small amounts in sort of dribs and drabs as we went along the journey, which I think is actually a really good way to raise, in my opinion. So I think a good way to raise and a compelling way to raise is raise for specific things. I think Tim mentioned something on your episode, right? Where it was like, you raise for specific things, okay? We need to achieve this next thing. This next milestone?
Because the milestone is not in the raising. It's in what comes after.
Yeah. Exactly. So I thought we took a very similar approach. But our goal was to raise to never have to raise again. That was our main goal. And what happened was we did often, transparently speaking, get into like conversations with funds. We've had term sheets. And Ben always asked me this question when we've had the term sheet ready to sign. And he would say, we're doing like 60K in profit every month. Do we actually need to raise? And I'm like, that's such a good question. Mm. Let's go back and model it and see if we actually need to raise. And then we plan out our next 2 years and say, we actually don't need to. Mm. We always withdrew from those sort of instances.
And that must have been quite tough, because I remember those moments where you would get the term sheets and you'd be like, especially when you're seeing all your peers raise, yeah. It takes a lot of discipline to be like, actually, we don't need this.
It does. And I think if a specific group of investors met, they'll say, this Sate guy, he took us all the way. But yeah, I got a rejection email from a fund, one of sort of Europe's leading funds. And it was the best email. I probably should actually frame this email, right? And this email essentially said, so I remember pitching to them and I remember coming off the call and saying, I smashed that. There's no way they can't invest, right? And they went away for a while, a week, 2 weeks. And I was like, what's going on here? So I followed up. And then the email essentially said, she said, sorry for the delay. The reason why it took long is we were deliberating a lot. We think you're amazing and you will have a great business. We just don't think that it's VC worthy. We think you will get to around 25 million annually. You build a profitable business, but you will start to plateau from there. And I said, 25 mil. That's not bad, you know.
You're like,
that's a good outcome. And you're telling me I don't have to raise and I can do it at my pace and we are in control of our
destiny.
That is
so funny. That's not what most people would have gotten from that email. People are like, oh my God, that's sad. You're like, whoa, this is good.
I said, that's good, because I always knew that this is a platform for something else. Yeah. Right?
And I remember when you had that moment, and I think it almost... It put you back in control of your destiny, right?
100%. And I remember, you'll never think a rejection email would be sort of like the confidence booster, right? But it really was. And like, I refer to that email a lot because those trends are actually what we're seeing, right? We are seeing a plateau. We are seeing it actually start to slow, because it's a very commoditized market, to be honest. It's very difficult to gain an edge. There are a lot of race to the bottom economics happening. So it's not that ripe for a typical venture fund story. And I think another bit of advice I always give to young entrepreneurs is figure out your story. There's no bad. Just figure out your story, right?
And
own it, right? And just lean into it. And remember that this is not your last opportunity or this is not. And I always see things as like the stepping stone. And this, obviously, we've built a great business. We serve almost like 90 customers. And that's like, you wouldn't consider that a stepping stone, but we're very ambitious people. We're just very measured in our ambition in a way that we think about it.
Talk to us about that ambition, because I know that with Pimento, your ambitions is to serve 1 in 200 parcels in the UK.
Yeah.
So this is obviously has the potential to be a venture scale business. So talk to us about that transition from receiving that email, hearing that it's not a venture backable business, but now building Pimento, which is, and how that may have changed your view of ambition and what you want to achieve.
Yeah, so with Hutch, we were always ambitious. It's just when I still spoke to some funds after that email, and I felt like I was being dishonest to a certain degree. I felt like we had been, founders are sort of taught to sell the sizzle and sell the vision. But deep down, I was like, this is not going to get to 100 mil in the time frame that you want it to get to 100 mil. And if it does, we would have to, it's a capital intensive business. We will have to raise and raise and raise and raise. And we're seeing it with all of the incumbents that have gone down that journey, that it's not easy, and they're all struggling. So I think like from my perspective, I didn't want to, and sometimes when we had these term sheets as well, Ben and I would be like, are we actually going to make this happen? I know it's cool. A lot of entrepreneurs would say, just take the money. But I think they forget that it actually shapes your trajectory. It shapes your day to day. It shapes who you hire, who you choose to work with.
Your strategy sometimes. Because now you're not just building it alone. You have partners who have expectations.
Exactly. So it shapes everything. So I think we're very, very mindful. And we have nothing against the VC venture-backed journey. We just knew it wasn't right for that business. So I think the opportunity we see with Pimento is the typical ones you see, right? That scream venture-backed. Massive market, growing market. Current incumbents are not growing fast enough. We think we can take their lunch money. We think we've got a far superior product. We think we can take UK, Europe. It's scalable. You can do it. You can scale into the US. You can do all of these things, all of the sort of common signs. And I think it's just about, identifying what is the right vehicles that you can use to grow your business for your business, essentially.
And maybe even on that question, what are the ambitions for Pimento? Like, what do you hope it becomes? Everything goes well. What does the world look like?
Yeah. So I think Yvonne mentioned it, 1 in 200 parcels.
Yeah.
So currently we're like 1 in 1700. So we've got a way to go. But really what that means is we think that most of the incumbents at the moment focus on just what happens within the four walls of your warehouse, right? Inventory management, order management, and so on. Pimento is very different where we do that, but we build for every stakeholder in that chain, right? So the brands have a suite of tools, right? The 3PLs have a suite of tools to manage their business. You can run your invoices through it and it can tell you where your couriers have overcharged you, for example, right? So all of these tools to actually manage your business. And the way we see it in the future is we want to be that layer for e-commerce and e-commerce brands and 3PLs to really, really deliver great experiences to their customers and run profitable operations and allow them to scale in a way that's not possible at the moment.
I feel like it's impossible to have conversations on tech now without AI.
Yes.
So like, did you have to think of your strategy with the product? Does it have an AI component? Is it something you're like, we'll figure, I don't know. What's your thinking with the product, with that ambition in mind?
Yeah, so one of the things that, luckily I'm 33 now, and I've been in the startup world since my early 20s, and I've seen phases. AI is not a phase. I have to be super clear. It's not a phase. However, the way founders and funds and the whole ecosystem rush to these trends like, I don't know, like flies in the
flame.
Sometimes I think it's not conducive to thinking through the problem.
Yeah, we're seeing that initial corporate rush start to wane. I think you're totally right.
Exactly. So I think for us, we know that there's opportunities. It's always about problem backwards and not just how do we figure out AI and squeeze it into the product. Now, we already have some versions of like AI logic. So for example, one of the large problems that a lot of warehouses operations have is, I guess you've all ordered from Amazon where you order a pencil and it comes in a box this big, right?
Like, this is not
such a waste.
It's such a waste, right?
Yeah.
The issue is the packers who are packing the orders typically go for the easiest one because it's just easy to throw it in, right? Or they go for the one that's closest to reach, but there's no logic that tells them what's the best box to choose for those products. So we've actually built systems that essentially tell the packer based on the dimensions of the product. The systems know, oh, that's a jumper, so you can actually fold it. That's going into a mailer bag, so the mailer bag folds, so all of these different things. So we have little glimpses of that. And ultimately, there's going to be way more opportunities within a product to do that. But we're not forcing the issue.
I love it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the team because you had led teams at the places you had operated at. But I imagine that building your own business and having to actually build a tech platform out of that means you have to think about team differently. There's something you said earlier that kind of gave a hint into the kind of culture you might have in your organization. It's like experiments, like get those insights through experimentation and then use those insights to build a stable business. Tell me a little bit about how you thought about your team, your culture. What kind of company did you and Ben want to build? How do you guys balance out in terms of the traits that you imprint upon the business? We'd love to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. Like Ben and I are we started off very different in terms of the way we thought about business. We've come closer. We've even swapped the way we think at times, right? A lot of people ask like, oh, who wins the most debates and the most in business arguments? And the truth is, it's actually dependent on the phase and the season that the business is in. One becomes the winner more often than the other. So when we are in a operational, we need to actually focus on our numbers, get profitable. Ben is mostly right in that phase. When it comes to let's grow, fill the warehouse, grow our capacity. I'm typically the winner in those debates and those seasons, right? And I think one of the challenges we have is actually guiding the team through those seasons, right? Because you gear them to be, all right, guys, all we're going to focus on is profitability. No wastage. And then we're like, okay, we've built this amazing warehouse, but we've got 60% capacity that we need to fill. And now you've got to shift the team's mindset to growth. And that's actually quite difficult because you either need to train people to think in those different mindsets. You either need to hire people that can flip between the two.
Yeah.
or you're either gonna come up short, and you're gonna find when you switch to one phase, they can't actually
adapt.
So we think about it as like when I speak to a lot of founders and teams, I find that they define who they are as a company quite broadly and say this is who we are all the time. But the truth is your company goes through phases. So it's not who you are all the time. It's who do we need to be in this, phase at this point. And then when the demand economy changes, when the landscape changes, if there's an opportunity, sometimes we've said, all right, guys, we're just going to buckle down a little bit, focus on profitability, focus on our efficiencies. And then a 3PL down the road shuts down. And we're like, we need to go to growth mode and go and grab all of those customers. And I switch everyone over quickly. So yeah, I think we think about it in sort of seasons, roundabouts, and get the team ready. So we'll do like a big presentation and say, guys, we are now in growth mode. Now, all you care about is scale. If we're doing stand up and more than 20% of what you say you're doing today is not to do with growth,
you're come to me and tell me you're doing it wrong.
So we think about it in that way and we move through the motions accordingly. I love that.
How large is the team now?
So the Hutch team is around, I guess, like 35 people or so. And Pimento's at like 6-7 people.
I'm curious, Pimento, how did you land on that name? It's a pepper, is it not?
It's one of my favorite seasons.
Like, really? Yeah,
that's,
I was like...
that's all. Like, I use it all the time. Like, I make soups a lot.
Oh, you just dash in Pimento. Okay, I was just curious. Then one more question. You know, there's this notion of founders scaling themselves. What resources did you have to lean on? What, you know, networks? How did you organize to make sure that... Because you come across as a very self-aware person on where your gaps are and where your strengths are. So how did you keep... You know, what systems, mental models did you use to just continue to stay abreast so that, for you know, for the benefit of others as well?
Yeah, so I think I love the concept of postmortems. And I think people think about postmortems where you sort of, I guess, retrospectively look at a failure. Not even only a failure, but even a success and try and work through that. I think people do those too infrequently. Mm-hmm. I think you can apply it to small scale projects, tasks. You can do a post-mortem meeting after an investor call where you sit with yourself and say, what did I do? What did I not do? And so on. And I've done a lot of that. I've got a lot of writing after small moments, big moments.
So really you write moments. Like a reflective writing.
Always. And I write a lot of those down and then try and implement those changes. I really try not to make the same mistake more than once. And I think it's really helpful to write those mistakes and errors down, or I could have done this a bit better. It goes down to things like even the other day I was at a networking event and I kept forgetting people's names. I said, this is bad practice. I can't forget people's names. So I went home and I wrote, from now on, I would study to not forget people's names. And I spent a lot of time watching videos on how to not. So it's like that sort of commitment to self-improvement in a lot of the little ways. I think as well, team-wise as well, we spend a lot of time, doing team retrospectives as well. It's always about just learning and trying to implement those changes and be very, very honest and create that culture where failure is not necessarily a bad thing. And I think, that's definitely gone a long way. And I think also the last thing I'll add is one of the key things we hire for, and this is because these are the people I want around me, it's highly opinionated people.
Ooh, what's the mental model there? Why highly opinionated? Because you could also argue, someone might say, like, if you have too many opinionated people in a room, it's hard to move forward. But what? How did you think about that? I think
the way, especially at Hutch, like, there are departments and individuals fighting for different things, right? But on the surface, it looks like they're fighting for different things. So, for example, the warehouse team are fighting for the most efficient way to do things. But then the customer experience team are like, we want to deliver the greatest experience to customers. So a customer might say, I want you to put tissue paper in the boxes and fold it in this particular way, right? My thinking is, let them fight it out. Let the warehouse say, no, that's not efficient. Let the customer experience team say, no, but we have to make it happen for the customer. And give them the framework and the cultural space for them to land in the middle, right? So that company as a whole wins. So we have a bit of everything, right? So I try to encourage that we call it like internal beef, right? We try to encourage that internal beef. Like we always say, oh, they have an internal beef. Let them figure it out. And then they come back and say, okay, this is what we've landed on. And in 8 out of 10 cases, it's always a happy medium. But you can't do that unless you have you've empowered everyone to fight their corner and be super opinionated about their part of the business, right? We can even go further with the opinionated part. It's so easy to think that as founders, we're the authority and we know it all, right? But you hire people to bring in their experiences, their expertise, and so on. And what you really want is you want to be told that you're, as a founder, your idea is stupid. And you want to give them the space to be able to say that to me, to say that to Ben. And sometimes we have like, let's say, for example, we have a big deal. A big deal's on the table. We're discussing pricing, right? This happens all the time. And that is probably where the most different. Some of the team are win it at all costs, give them a discount in the first year and then price it up in the second year. Some of us are very P&L. No, we can't lose money on this and so on. But what we always typically land on is this happy medium where we make money, we win the deal, we come up with something creative to appease all
There's always room to find something that works if you allow the creative conflict to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's sort of what we try to encourage. And yeah, even now I'm thinking about the senior, I've got their faces in my head and I'm just thinking, you're super opinionated. But no, it works. It really does.
I love it. We tend to end with a retrospective exercise because I think we're coming at the end of the conversation. And one of the things we ask is just an exercise for you to go back to your past self. Imagine you had a time machine just as you started Hatch, just as you started thinking of Pimentum as well, and you could meet Sate at that time, 10 seconds. What would you tell him? Not necessarily to change anything, but what do you think he needed to hear at that point in time? And maybe that message resonates with someone who's listening.
Yeah, continue to back yourself. I think one of the biggest qualities I have is I just always back myself. And I'll back myself to figure it out and make it work. Sometimes it comes into doubt. But I think I would love to expel those doubts and just be, always remind myself to place bets on yourself, because my track record is I always figure it out and make it happen. So I think, yeah, continue to back yourself and place bets on yourself is probably be it.
I love it. Yeah. Fantastic. Maybe one last one. If there was someone else you'd want to see on the show, who would it be?
Oh, probably my friend Ivan at Severa. Okay. If you've heard of that company,
okay,
medical yeah, company, very interesting guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No, it's
an amazing conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you
for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review. Tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.